This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we start with a story from the November 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Face Value by Karen Joy Fowler. It was almost like being alone. Taki, who had been alone one way or another most of his life, recognized this and thought he could deal with it. What choice did he have? It was only that he had allowed himself to hope for something different. A second star, small and dim, joined the sun in the sky, making its appearance over the rope bridge that spanned the empty river. Taki crossed the bridge in a hurry to get inside before the hardest part of the day began. Something flashed briefly in the dust at his feet, and he stooped to pick it up. It was one of Hesper's poems, half finished, left out all night. Taki had stopped reading Hesper's poetry. It reflected nothing, not a whisper of her life here with him, but was filled with longing for things and people behind her. Taki pocketed the poem on his way to the house, stood outside the door, and removed what dust he could with the stiff brush that hung at the entrance. He keyed his admittance. The door made a slight sucking sound as it resealed behind him. Hesper had set out an iced glass of aid for him. Taki drank it at a gulp, superimposing his own dusty fingerprints over hers, sketched lightly in the condensation on the glass. The drink was heavily sugared and only made him thirstier. A cloth curtain separated one room from another, a blue sheet, Hesper's innovation, since the dwelling was designed as a single, multifunctional space. Through the curtain, Taki heard a voice and knew Hesper was listening again to her mother's letter, earth weather, the romances of her younger cousins. The letter had arrived weeks ago, but Taki was careful not to remind Hesper how old its news really was. If she chose to imagine the lives of her family moving along the same timeline as her own, then this must be a fantasy she needed. She knew the truth. In the time it had taken her to travel here with Taki, her mother had grown old and died. Her cousins had settled into marriages, happy or unhappy, or had faced life alone. The letters that continued to arrive with some irregularity were an illusion. A lifetime later, Hesper would answer them. Taki ducked through the curtain to join her. "Hot," he told her, as if this were news. She lay on their mat, stomach down, legs bent at the knees, feet crossed in the air. Her hair, the color of dried grasses, hung over her face. Taki stared for a moment at the back of her head. "Here," he said. He pulled out her poem from his pocket and laid it by her hand. "I found this out front." Hesper switched off the letter and rolled onto her back away from the poem. She was careful not to look at Taki. Her cheeks were stained with irregular red patches, so that Taki knew she had been crying again. The observation caused him a familiar mixture of sympathy and impatience. His feelings for Hesper always came in these uncomfortable combinations. It tired him. "Out front," Hesper repeated, and her voice held a practiced tone of uninterested nastiness. "And how did you determine that one part of this featureless landscape was the front?" "Because of the door. We have only the front door, so it's the front door." "No," said Hesper. "If we had two doors, then one might arguably be the front door and the other the back door. But with only one, it's just the door." Her gaze went straight upward. "You use words so carelessly, words from another world. They mean nothing here." Her eyelids fluttered briefly. the lashes darkened with tears. "It's not just an annoyance to me, you know," she said. "It can't help but damage your work." "My work is the study of the meaning," Taki answered, "not the creation of a new language." And Hesper's eyes closed. "I really don't see the difference," she told him. She lay a moment longer without moving, then opened her eyes and looked at Taki directly. "I don't want to have this conversation. I don't know why I started it. Let's rewind, run it again. I'll be the wife this time. You come in and say, 'Honey, I'm home,' and I'll ask you how your morning was." Taki began to suggest that this was a scene from another world and would mean nothing here. He had not yet framed the sentence when he heard the door seal release and saw Hesper's face go hard and white. She reached for her poem and slid it under the scarf at her waist. Before she could get to her feet, the first of the meanie had joined them in the bedroom. Taki ducked through the curtain to fasten the door before the temperature inside the house rose. The outer room was filled with dust, and the hands that reached out to him as he went past left dusty streaks on his clothes and his skin. He countered eight of the meanie, fluttering about him like large moths the size of human children, but with furry vestigial wings, hourglass abdomens, stick-like limbs. They danced around him in the open spaces, looked through the cupboards, and pulled the tapes from his desk. When they had their backs to him, he could see the symmetrical arrangement of dark spots that marked their wings in a pattern resembling a human face, a very sad face, very distinct, masculine, Taki had always thought, but Hesper disagreed. The party that had made initial contact under the leadership of Hans Meanie so many years ago had wisely found the faces too whimsical for mention in their report. Instead, they had included pictures and allowed them to speak for themselves. Perhaps the original explorers had been asking the same questions Hesper posed the first time Taki showed her the pictures. Was the face really there? Or was this only evidence of the ability of humans to see their own faces in everything? Hesper had a poem titled The Kitchen God, which recounted the true story of a woman about a century ago who had found the image of Christ in the burn marks on a tortilla. "Did they see it too?" she had asked Taki. But there was as yet no way to ask this of the meanie, no way to know if they had reacted with shock and recognition to the faces of the first humans they had seen, though studies of the meanie eye suggested a finer depth perception which might significantly distort the flat image. Taki thought that Hesper's own face had changed since the day only 6 months ago, calculated as travel time, when she said she would come here with him, and he thought it was because she loved him. They had sorted through all the information that had been collected to date on the meanie, and her face had been all sympathy then. What would it be like, she asked him, to be able to fly and then to lose this ability, to outgrow it? What would a loss like that do to the racial consciousness of a species? It happened so long ago, I doubt it's even noticed as a loss, Taki had replied. I regard legends, myths, not really believed, perhaps. Probably not even that. In the racial memory, not even a whisper. Hesper had ignored him. What a shame they don't write poetry, she had said. She was finding them less romantic now, as she joined Taki in the outer room, her face stoic. The meanie surrounded her, ran their string-fingered hands all over her body, inside her clothing. One meanie attempted to insert a finger into her mouth, but Hesper tightened her lips together resolutely, dust on her chin. Her eyes were fastened on Taki, accusingly, beseechingly. Taki was no good at reading people's eyes. He looked away. Eventually, the meanie grew bored. They left in groups, a few lingering behind to poke among the boxes in the bedroom, then following the others until Hesper and Taki were left alone. Hesper went to wash herself as thoroughly as their limited water supply allowed. Taki swept up the loose dust. Before he finished, Hesper returned, showing him her empty jewelry box without a word. The jewelry had all belonged to her mother. "I'll get it when it cools," Taki told her. "Thank you." It was always Hesper's things that the meanie took. The more they disgusted her, pawing over her, rummaging through her things, no way to key the door against clever meanie fingers, even if Taki had agreed to lock them out, which he had not, the more fascinating they seemed to find her. They touched her twice as often as they touched Taki, and much more insistently. They took her jewelry, her poems, her letters, all the things she treasured most, and Taki believed, although it was far too early in his studies, really to speculate with any assurance, that the meanie read something off the subjects. The initial explorers had concluded that meanie communication was entirely telepathic, and if this were accurate, then Taki's speculation was not such a leap. Certainly, the meanie didn't value the objects for themselves. Taki always found them discarded in the dust on this side of the rope bridge. The fact that everything would be easily recovered did nothing to soften Hesper's sense of invasion. She mixed herself a drink, stirring it with the metal straw that poked through the dustproof lid. "You shouldn't allow it," she said at last, and Taki knew from the time that had elapsed that she had tried not to begin this familiar conversation. He appreciated her effort as much as he was annoyed by her failure. "It's part of my job," he reminded her. "We have to be accessible to them. I study them. They study us. There's no way to differentiate the two activities, and certainly no way to establish communication except simultaneously. You're letting them study us, but you're giving them a false picture. You're allowing them to believe that humans intrude on each other in this way. Does it occur to you that they may be involved in similar charades? If so, what?" Taki took a deep breath. "The need for privacy may not be as intrinsically human as you imagine. I could point to many societies prior to the plagues that afforded very little of this. As for any deliberate misrepresentations on their part, well, isn't that the whole rationale for not sending a study team? Wouldn't I be further along if I were working with environmentalists, physiologists, linguists? But the risk of contamination increases exponentially with each additional human. We would be too much of a presence. Of course, I will be very careful. I am far from the stage in my study where I can begin to draw conclusions. When I visit them, reinforcing the notion that such visits are ordinary human behavior," Hesper was looking at Taki with great coolness. "When I visit them, I am much more circumspect," Taki finished. "I conduct my study as unobtrusively as possible." "And what do you imagine you are studying?" Hesper asked. She closed her lips tightly over the straw and drank. Taki regarded her steadily and with exasperation. "Is this a trick question?" he asked. "I imagine I am studying the meanie." "What do you imagine I am studying?" "What humans always study," said Hesper. "Humans." "You never saw one of the meanie alone, not ever. One never wandered off to watch the sunset or took its food to a solitary hole to eat without sharing. They did everything in groups, and although Taki had been observing them for weeks now and was able to identify individuals and had compiled charts of the groupings he had seen, trying to isolate families or friendships or work castes, Still, the results were inconclusive. His attempts at communication were similarly discouraging. He had tried verbalizations, but had not expected a response to them. He had no idea how they processed audio information, although they could hear. He had tried clapping and gestures, simple hand signals for the names of common objects. He had no sense that these efforts were noticed. They were so unfocused when he dealt with them, fluttering here, fluttering there. Taki's ESP quotient had never been measurable, yet he tried that route too. He tried to send a simple command. He would trap a meanie hand and hold it against his own cheek, trying to form in his mind the picture that corresponded to the action. When he released the hand, sticky, meanie fingers might linger for a moment, or they might slip away immediately, tangle in his hair instead, or tap his teeth. Meanie teeth were tiny and pointed like wires. Taki saw them only when the meanie ate. At other times, they were hidden inside the folds of skin that almost hid their eyes as well. Taki speculated that the skin flaps protected their mouths and eyes from the dust. Taki found meanie faces less expressive than their backs. Head on, they appeared petaled and blind as flowers. When he wanted to differentiate one meanie from another, Taki looked at their wings. Hesper had warned them there would be no art, and he had asked her, how could she be so sure? Because their communication system is perfect, she said. Out of one brain and into the next, with no loss of meaning, no need for abstraction, art arises from the inability to communicate. Art is the imperfect symbol, isn't it? But Taki, watching the meanie carry water up from their underground deposits, asked himself where the line between tools and art objects should be drawn. For no functional reason that he could see, the water containers curved in the centers, like the shapes of the meanie's own abdomens. Taki followed the meanie below ground, down some shallow, rough-cut states into the darkness. The meanie themselves were slightly luminescent when there was no other light. At times and seasons, some were spectacularly so, and Taki's best guess was that this was sexual. Even with the dimmer members, Taki could see well enough. He moved through a long tunnel with a low ceiling that made him stoop. He could hear water at the other end of it, not the water itself, but a special quality to the silence that told him water was near. The lake was clearly artificial, collected during the rainy season, which no human had seen yet. The tunnel narrowed sharply. Taki could have gone forward, but felt suddenly claustrophobic and backed out instead. What did the meanie think, he wondered, of the fact that he came here without Hesper? Did they notice this at all? Did it teach them anything about humans that they were capable of understanding? Their lives together are perfect, Hesper said, except for those useless wings. If they are ever able to talk with us at all, it will be because of those wings. Of course, Hesper was a poet. The world was all language, as far as she was concerned. When Taki first met Hesper at a party given by a colleague of his, he had asked her what she did. I name things, she had said. I try to find the right names for things. In retrospect, Taki thought it was bullshit. He couldn't remember why he had been so impressed with it at the time. A deliberate miscommunication when a simple answer, I write poetry, would have been so clear and easy to understand. He felt the same way about her poetry itself, needlessly obscure, slightly evocative, but it left the reader feeling that he had fallen short somehow, that it had been a test and he had flunked it. It was unkind poetry, and Taki had worked so hard to read it then. "Am I right?" he would ask her anxiously when he finished. "Is this what you're saying?" But she would answer that the poem spoke for itself. "Once it's on the page, I've lost control over it. Then the reader determines what it says or how it works." Hesper's eyes were gray, the irises so large and intense within their dark rings that they made Taki dizzy. "So you're always right by definition, even if it's not remotely close to what I intended." What Taki really wanted was to find himself in Hesper's poems. He would read them anxiously for some symbol that could be construed as him, some clue as to his impact on her life. But he was never there. It was against policy to send anyone into the field alone. There were pros and cons, of course, but ultimately, the isolation of a single professional was seen as too cruel. For shorter projects, there were advantages in sending a threesome, but during a longer study, the group dynamics in a trio often became difficult. Two was considered ideal, and Taki knew that Raji and Hayan had applied for this post, a husband and wife team in which both members were trained for this type of study. He had never stopped being surprised that the post had been offered to him instead. He could not even have been considered if Hesper had not convinced the committee of her willingness to accompany him, but she must have done much more. She must have impressed someone very much for them to decide that one trained xenologist and one poet might be more valuable than two trained xenologists. The committee had made some noises about possible contamination occurring between the two trained professionals, but Taki found this argument specious. "What did you say to them?" he asked her after her interview, and she shrugged. "You know," she said, "words." Taki had hidden things from her committee during his own interview, things about Hesper, her moods, her deep attachment to her mother, her unreliable attachment to him. He must have known it would never work out, but he walked about in those days with the stunned expression of a man who had been given everything. Could he be blamed for accepting it? Could he be blamed for believing in Hesper's unexpected willingness to accompany him? It made a sort of equation for Taki. If Hesper were willing to give up everything and come with Taki, then Hesper loved Taki. An ordinary marriage commitment was reviewed every 5 years. This was something much greater. No other explanation made any sense. The equation still held a sort of inevitability for Taki. Then Hesper loved Taki, if Hesper were willing to come with him. So somehow, sometime, Taki had done something that lost him Hesper's love. If he could figure out what, perhaps he could make her love him again. "Do you love me?" he had asked Hesper only once. He had too much pride for these thinly disguised pleadings. "Love is such a difficult word," she had answered, but her voice had been filled with a rare softness and had not hurt Taki as much as it might. The day star was appearing again when Taki returned home. Hesper had made a meal, which suggested she was coping well today. It included a sort of pudding made of a local fruit they had found themselves able to tolerate. Hesper called the pudding box tea. It was apparently a private joke. Taki was grateful for the food and the joke, even if he didn't understand it. He tried to keep the conversation lighthearted, talking to Hesper about the meanie water jars. Taki's position was that when the form of a practical object was less utilitarian than it might be, then it was art. Hesper laughed. She ran through a list of human artifacts and made him classify them. A paperclip, she said. The shape hasn't changed in centuries, he told her. Not art. A safety pin. Taki hesitated. How essential was the coil at the bottom of the pin? Very. Not art, he decided. A hairbrush. Boar bristle? Wood handle? Art, definitely. She smiled at him. You're confusing ornamentation with art. But why not? It's as good a definition as any, she told him. Eat your boxty. They spent the whole afternoon alone, uninterrupted. Taki transcribed the morning's notes into his files and reviewed his tapes. Hesper recorded a letter whose recipient would never hear it and sang softly to herself. That night, he reached for her, his hand along the curve at her waist. She stiffened slightly, but responded by putting her hand on his face. He kissed her, and her mouth did not move. His movements became less gentle. It might have been passion. It might have been anger. She told him to stop, but he didn't, couldn't, wouldn't. Stop, she said again, and he heard she was crying. They're here. Please stop. They're watching us. Studying us, Taki said. Let them. But he rolled away and released her. They were alone in the room. He would have seen the meanie easily in the dark. Hesper, he said, there's no one here. She lay rigid on her side of their bed. He saw the stitching of her backbone disappearing into her neck and had a sudden feeling that he could see everything about her, how she was made, how she was held together. It made him no less angry. I'm sorry, Hesper told him, but he didn't believe her. Even so, he was asleep before she was. He made his own breakfast the next morning without leaving anything out for her. He was gone before she had gotten out of bed. The meanie were gathering food, dried husks thick enough to protect the liquid fruit during the two-star dry season. They punctured the husks with their needle-thin teeth. Several crowded about him, greeting him with their fingers, checking his pockets, removing his recorder and passing it about until one of them dropped it in the dust. When they returned to work, Taki retrieved it, wiped it as clean as he could. He sat down to watch them, logged everything he observed. He noted in particular how often they touched each other and wondered what each touch meant. Affection? Communication? Some sort of chain of command? Later, he went underground again, choosing another tunnel, looking for one that wouldn't narrow so as to exclude him, but finding himself beside the same lake with the same narrow access ahead. He went deeper this time until it gradually became too close for his shoulders. Before him, he could see a luminescence. He smelled the dusty odor of the meanie and could just make out a sound, too, a sort of movement, a grass rubbing together sound. He stooped and strained his eyes to see something in the faint light. It was like looking into the small end of a pair of binoculars. The tunnel narrowed and narrowed. Beyond it must be the meanie homes, and he could never get into them. He contrasted this with the easy access they had to his home. At the end of his vision, he thought he could just see something move, but he wasn't sure. A light touch on the back of his neck and another behind his knee startled him. He twisted around to see a group of the Meanie crowded into the tunnel behind him. It gave him the feeling of being trapped, and he had to force himself to be very gentle as he pushed his way back and let the Meanie go through. The dark pattern of their wings stood in high relief against the luminescent bodies. The human faces grew smaller and smaller until they disappeared. "Leave me alone," Hesper told him. It took Taki completely by surprise. He had done nothing but enter the bedroom. He had not even spoken yet. "Just leave me alone." Taki saw no signs that Hesper had ever gotten up. She lay against the pillow, and her cheek was still creased from the wrinkles in the sheet. She had not been crying. There was something worse in her face, something that alarmed Taki. "Hesper," he asked, "Hesper, did you eat anything? Let me get you something to eat." It took Hesper a moment to answer. When she did, she looked ordinary again. "Thank you," she said. "I am hungry." She joined him in the outer room, wrapped in their blanket, her hair tangled around her face. She got a drink for herself, dropping the empty glass once, stooping to retrieve it. Taki had the strange impression that the glass fell slowly. When they first arrived, the gravitational pull had been light, just perceptibly lighter than Earth's. Without quite noticing, this had registered on him in a sort of light-heartedness. But Hesper had complained of feelings of dislocation, disconnection. Taki put together a cold breakfast that Hesper ate slowly, watching her own hands as if they fascinated her. Taki looked away. "Fork," she said. He looked back. She was smiling at him. "What?" "Fork." He understood. "Not art." "Four tines?" He didn't answer. "Roses carved on the handle?" "Well, then art, because of the handle, not because of the tines." He was greatly reassured. The Meanie came while he was telling her about the tunnel. They put their dusty fingers in her food, pulled it apart. Hesper set her fork down and pushed the plate away. When they reached for her, she pushed them away too. They came back. Hesper shoved harder. "Hesper," said Taki, "I just want to be left alone. They never leave me alone." Hesper stood up, towering above the Meanie. The blanket fell to the floor. "We flew here," Hesper said to the Meanie. "Did you see the ship? Didn't you see the pod? Doesn't that interest you, flying?" She laughed and flapped her arms until they froze horizontal at her side. The Meanie reached for her again, and she brought her arms in to protect her breasts, pushing the Meanie away repeatedly, harder and harder, until they were tired of approaching her and went into the bedroom, reappearing with her poems in their hands, the door sealed behind them. "I'll get them back for you," Taki promised, but Hesper told him not to bother. "I haven't written in weeks," she said, "in case you hadn't noticed. I haven't finished a poem since I came here. I've lost that, along with everything else." She brushed at her hair rather frantically with one hand. "It doesn't matter," she added. "My poem's not art." "Are you the best person to judge that?" Taki said. "Don't patronize me," Hesper returned to the table, looked again at the plate that held her unfinished breakfast, dusty from handling. "My critical faculties are still intact. It's just the poetry that's gone." She took the dish to clean it, scraped the food away. "I was never any good," she said. "Why do you think I came here? I had no poetry of my own, so I thought I'd write the Meanies. I came to a world without words. I hoped it would be clarifying. I knew there was a risk." Her hands moved very fast. "I want you to know I don't blame you." "Come and sit down a moment, Hesper," Taki said, but she shook her head. She looked down at her body and moved her hands over it. They feel sorry for us. Did you know that? They feel sorry about our bodies. How do you know that? Taki asked. Logic. We have these completely functional bodies. No useless wings, not art. Hesper picked up the blanket and headed for the bedroom. At the cloth curtain, she paused a moment. They love our loneliness, though. They've taken all mine. They never leave me alone now. She thrust her right arm suddenly out into the air. It made the curtain ripple. Go away, she said, ducking behind the sheet. Taki followed her. He was very frightened. No one is here but us. Hesper, he told her. He tried to put his arms around her, but she pushed him back and began to dress. Don't touch me all the time, she said. He sank onto the bed and watched her. She sat on the floor to fasten her boots. Are you going out, Hesper? He asked, and she laughed. Hesper is out, she said. Hesper is out of place, out of time, out of luck, and out of her mind. Hesper has vanished completely. Hesper was broken into and taken. Taki fastened his hands tightly together. Please don't do this to me, Hesper, he pleaded. It's really so unfair. When did I ask so much of you? I took what you offered me. I never took anything else. Please don't do this. Hesper had found the brush and was pulling it roughly through her hair. He rose and went to her, grabbing her by the arms, trying to turn her to face him. Please, Hesper. She shook loose from him without really appearing to notice his hands and continued to work through the worst of her tangles. When she did turn around, her face was familiar, but somehow not Hesper's face. It was a face that startled him. Hesper is gone, it said. We have her. You've lost her. We are ready to talk to you, even though you will never, never, never understand. She reached out to touch him, laying her open palm against his cheek and leaving it there. We continue with a brief poem from the same issue, Epicenter. A faint rumble, the desk shakes and echo. Adrenalized, my hands falter above the Apple keyboard and begin to enter a new line. A faint rumble, the desk shakes. It's as if earthquakes follow the physics in a bubble chamber where atoms are altered or decayed. I collapsed from balancing my checkbook into this poem, this echo, by Robert Fraser. We conclude with a story from the September 1986 issue of the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Business as Usual by Bill Johnson. The night Broca made his move, I was stuffed into a tight suit for a fundraising cocktail party. The governor, trim, gray-haired, and distinguished as hell, looked the part of a presidential candidate. A fat woman had him cornered, and I was about to launch a rescue party when I noticed her dress was designer and guessed her diamonds were real. I shrugged and avoided his eye when he tried to signal. We all have to suffer sometimes, and the campaign needed the money. Instead, I wandered by the bar, three deep in the husbands who wrote the checks to keep their wives happy and made sure the scotch was well watered. I turned to leave when I saw Broca. I admit I winced. Early in the campaign, we put out a set of position papers. One of them, the governor's personal favorite, brought up the old idea of a nuclear freeze. I tried to talk him out of it, said the issue had been dead for at least a decade, but he could be stubborn as an Ozark muse when he wanted. Broca's pack sent a contribution when the governor's idea stirred some interest. Unfortunately, Broca's was the only pack to contribute. Broca's skin was red and splotchy, and his gums stretched back to expose his teeth like fangs. I wondered what disease he had and never shook his hand. His pack, however, wrote checks of the purest green. "Mr. Broca, how nice to you're losing in the polls," Broca said abruptly. "See you. The governor's positions have a great deal of support. He is not, however, identified with these positions. He lacks visibility," Broca complained. "Candy to a baby, kickbacks to a government contractor, money to a campaign manager. The smell of some things just wake you up." "I couldn't agree more, but visibility takes money," I said smoothly. "How much?" he asked. I named a moderately ridiculous number and hoped for a tenth of that. Broca nodded and wrote a check. I stared at the numbers and decided to do my good deed for the day. I went over and asked the fat lady if she wanted to dance. I almost froze off my... it was cold as a ditch digger's... Anyway, New Hampshire was not my favorite state. Until primary day. Second. What a beautiful word. Second. I couldn't believe it. And the other surprise candidate, the woman, came in first. The media went wild. If there was anything better than a close race, it was a close race between two unknown candidates. Suddenly, they had a chance to write new copy about a fresh face. The PAC money began to roll in, and the individual contributions and federal matching funds. But as fast as it came in, there was always something to spend it on. So I went to the campaign suite to talk about Broca and found the governor in the bathroom throwing up blood. No one was sure why the governor got the ulcers. Hell, no one was even sure they were ulcers. A biopsy showed healthy tissues that, well, just bled. Most of the time, the governor was all right, but lately things hadn't been looking so good. "How bad is it?" I asked. "Bad enough," the governor said as he wiped blood from his lips. "Maybe," I said, choosing my words carefully, "we should relax now, pass up Florida and save ourselves for the big Western primaries." The governor shook his head. He knew as well as I did that he had to contest Florida and every state from here on out if he wanted to win the nomination in Denver. "All right, then. I'm going to send you to a private little fundraiser, Broca's group, if you remember him. It should be a nice, relaxing evening." The governor was drunk. Well, his breath did smell like garlic, not booze, but he staggered. His eyes were glassy, and he was pale as a sheet. I figured it must have been a good party. I got him to his room, stripped him, and put him to bed. I used some toilet paper on his neck, where he seemed to have cut himself shaving. I carefully flushed the paper down the toilet, just so no rumors would start with some loudmouthed maid, and checked him one last time before I left. He was talking in his sleep, and he felt like he had a little fever. "He says 400 years. Couldn't believe it. Made me believe it. And he's never sick. Not once. God damn. Think of the good you could do in 400 years. Never even hurt anybody. God damn." "He's dying." I dear near choked on my lettuce. Broca just sat there with this pissed off look on his face. "You said he was healthy. You said there was nothing to worry about." I don't understand, I lied. If Broca cut off his PAC money, or if he went to the press. We had your governor checked out last night. A thorough physical. He's dying. The cut on his neck? You took a blood sample? I said. No, that's part of the treatment, Broca said uncomfortably. Treatment? You can cure him? A pack of doctors? But why not use the official medical pack? I asked. Broca tapped the ash off his cigarette and stared out the window. The night lights of the city spread out below us like fireflies over a lake. Have you ever heard of porphyria? It's a disease, a severe shortage of blood cells, red blood cells. Porphyriacs can't stand sunlight. Their gums recede like mine, and some other more unpleasant problems occur. In the Middle Ages, they came out only at night, and they drank blood to get their red count up. They were the original vampires. So you have this disease and you set up your own pack, a pack of vampires? Well, that's legal, I said calmly. Oh my God, I thought, what have I done? The Baptists will kill us if they find out. What is important is that, yes, we can cure him, but we're not sure if we should. The treatment is safe and harmless, but we don't really have porphyria. We have the symptoms of the disease, but ours is different. It's viral, and if we cure your governor, we have to infect him, and he automatically becomes one of us. You mean he'll look like you? I asked. I thought about television and shuddered. Better we should withdraw now. No, the virus will cure his disease first. It's only when firmly established that the outer features start to change. It will take about a decade before he looks like me, Broca said. A decade was enough for two terms, and during that time, if anyone noticed, we could claim stress of the office. Why the governor? Why save him? I asked. We support a nuclear freeze, Broca said. That may sound strange, but we have a problem. Our population is linked to yours. We need a particular blood factor to live. Every time we tap into a person for that blood, their immune system is suppressed. By the third time, the immune system is weakened enough for the virus to establish itself. Then the donor is one of us. We need a large human population to survive, to ensure that we don't turn too many donors into one of us. If the balance tips and we don't have enough donors, we die in an extremely unpleasant manner. And we can't think of anything that would reduce the population faster than a nuclear war. So you want to keep us alive, like cattle? I said. That is precisely the attitude that keeps us quiet, Broca said angrily. No, you're not like cattle. We're human too, and we're citizens, but we're different. And groups that are different tend to get killed. So it took a lot of courage for us to come out in public and try to help. And I'll be damned if I'll listen to you insult us. Sit down, I said. Broca slowly returned to his chair. All right. I don't particularly want to be blown to hell either. First, cure the governor. He seems to have hit a nerve with the freeze idea, but it needs him out front to keep pushing. And to keep pushing, you've got to keep winning, I said. Broca sighed and smiled. And to keep winning, you need money, Broca said. He took out his checkbook. For the first time in the conversation, I felt comfortable, like candy to a baby. All right, maybe I should have paid more attention, but it was time for the Florida primary, and after that, Super Tuesday and Super Monday and Texas, all leading up to California, and then the convention in Denver. The field was down to two candidates, the governor
and the woman, Marilyn Norton. Neither had enough delegates to win on the first ballot. That meant backroom deals and promises and the kind of action that a campaign manager got once in a lifetime. The governor finished the treatments with Broca, and the years seemed to drop off his face. He seemed stronger and healthier than he had in years. Everything was going our way. I knew it was too good to last. I thanked the investigator and paid him off. He offered to do more digging, but I had the uneasy feeling that I didn't want to know the answers. That didn't mean I wasn't going to find out, just that I wanted only one person to know. Like the old Russian saying that if three people get together to talk revolution, one is a fool, one is a saint, and one is a spy. Marilyn Norton did not exist. Oh, she was there, all right, in the records, birth, parents, school records, all the paper trail we leave through our life. But when the investigator tried to find those people, they did not exist. The hospital where she claimed to have born was torn down. Her old high school was an adult daycare center. All her close relatives seemed to be dead. She doesn't exist, Broca. She's not really alive. Who? Marilyn Norton, the other candidate, and she's amazingly alive for someone who doesn't exist. Hell, I danced with her at the opening ceremonies last night. Silence on the line, not even static. Broca? Is there something funny going on with Marilyn Norton? I think you should arrange a meeting. Just you and me and Norton and any advisor she wants to bring. Broca, is she a vampire? God, no. That's one thing you don't have to worry about. I hung up and poured myself a scotch. I sat for a moment, let the aroma bring back memories and smiles. Then I sighed and poured it down the sink and refilled the glass with water. The last thing I needed was a hangover. Broca and I met the opposition in a private room in the back of a restaurant. Denver spread out to the east, a cup of light between the mountains and the plains. We clearly saw the convention center, where the first ballot was indecisive. I thought we could win. Norton had more committed delegates than the governor, but I didn't think her campaign manager knew how to pick up uncommitted votes. Hell, I'd already promised defense and treasury to four state chairmen. Beautiful, isn't it? Norton said. She was a handsome woman, tall and dark. Her advisor sat next to her, a shorter woman dressed in black. Yes, I said, but you wonder how much it's worth for either of us if we come out of the convention with a party more interested in ripping itself apart than winning an election. I agree. That's why we're here, she said. You're very astute. That's exactly what I was thinking, I said. I know, she said. I will not sit here and eat with that man, her advisor shouted. We can't talk with these people, Broca complained. There is such a thing as professional courtesy, and only an amateur ignores that. I won't deal with amateurs. Amateur, amateur, the advisor shrieked. Witch, vampire. I gather you know each other, I said dryly. He was there in Salem during the witch trials, and he did nothing, the advisor said. And what did you want us to do? Broca asked. I could think of a few things. I looked sharply at Norton. She smiled and shrugged. So we both have skeletons in the closet, so to speak, she said. No, I can't read your mind all that well when you try to hide your thoughts. And we witches, like the vampires, have spent most of our time trying to stay out of the public eye. We don't know how to get elected, even if we can read minds and do other things. I think you're the person to see that the election gets done, no matter who supports me. Well, I always did want that office in the West Wing of the White House, and no one said it was going to be easy. Broca? Yes. Who else are we likely to run into in this campaign? I asked plaintively. He pursed his lips and looked thoughtful for a moment. Well, there are the werewolves. They need all that space for hunting, you see, so they tend to have large estates and join country clubs. I suppose they support the other party, but I've never heard of them getting involved in politics before. And then there are the herbalists. You call them witch doctors. Sometimes you just got to deal. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.